And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. At the time is 2 p.m. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So today we are doing Blue Mind Radio, that the waters of life may cool our heads and move all heat in our heads to our heart where it truly belongs, that we may pour water on conflagration. Now, mythologically, Venus emerges from the sea to guide us all and to take the lead. So our main guest in some minutes will be wonderful ally Wallace J. Nichols, longtime friend of show, research associate at the California Academy of Sciences, founder, co-director of Ocean Revolution, See the Wild and Live Blue. Lives in California, bless his heart, nearby, and his wonderful book, Blue Mind, that I'm so delighted. It is going mainstream. We're smuggling beauty and wisdom into mainstream. Beautiful review in the Washington Post and also the New York Times, and we will honor that water. But first, we welcome a fellow, I just learned, KPFA ally, John Perulis, to invite and animate the action that will be taking place on the water, well, close to the water, at the Oakland port. It's Block the Boat and Apartheid, which will be this Saturday, August 16th, sponsored by many people, including KPFA. So welcome, John Perulis.
Oh, thank you, Caroline. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, that is wonderful. So you were part of the camera crew on the Rainbow Warrior, you said, in 1985. You got off the boat before it was blown up by the French Secret Service. You've done many things. You've been engaged with, you know, labor and labor movements. You said that the labor, it was the trade unions in Palestine that put out a call to the trade unions in Oakland and in New York. Can you guide us into that, what this action is, how people can participate? What is its dedication, and how we can invite the ocean herself to participate?
Yeah, good point. Picket protest or call for a picket line on Saturday is a thing that has been organized and called for by many groups, including AROC, Arab Resource Organizing Center. If you Google AROC, their site will come up, and you can get more details about Saturday from there. Also, I'm working with the Transport Workers Solidarity Committee. One of the organizers for that is Jack Heyman of the ILWU, International Longshore and Warehouse Workers. ILWU has a long history, a very famous history. 1934 is a famous strike that got a lot of rights. And ILWU was the first union to integrate. And 1934, they also blocked Nazi boats.
And remind us what ILWU stands for.
It's the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union. And the first word in that is international. And the ILWU is no stranger to protest actions on the docks. I mentioned the blockade of Nazi boats in 1934. Also, in 2010, I was part of a crew from KPFA covering the blockade of a Zim ship at the Oakland docks, and that was successful. The local 10 and the other locals of ILWU did not cross the picket line, and we stopped the Israeli boat from unloading and protest the killing of activists on peace boats that were sailing to Palestine to deliver medical supplies.
Right. And we should, again, make the distinction, as this is, this action is sponsored, this peaceful, dynamic action to end apartheid and cruelty, you know, is sponsored by many, many groups, Labor for Palestine, Jews for Palestinian Right of Return.
Oh, yeah.
Many things. People are gathering at 5 a.m., meeting at the West Oakland BART, which is not open, so you'll have to carpool or bicycle or something there. And again, as you said, you know, during apartheid in South Africa, workers made history when they joined, when they blockaded these boats. So
yeah, that's correct. Even Desmond Tutu has now publicly said that what's happening in Gaza, the apartheid in Gaza, is worse than South Africa. Now, that's from one of the leaders of the anti-apartheid movement. So that should be carefully considered by people who are looking at this.
Well, we do. We want to pour cool waters and all join hands and jump into the cauldron, you know, that, you know, let's all compost, you know, any unexamined rages of sneaky colonial privilege and hyperventilating, that, again, the Israeli state is not the same as Jewish people. We want to really underline that this is an embracing of kinship. There, you know, in public forums, you know, it's not that many, but certainly vociferous. You know, if one posts, you know, about this action or parents grieving over their dead child, people go, "You're just hating Israel. You're hating Jewish people." It's like, no. No.
Yeah.
We will make that distinction. So this action is inviting all who are, we are all in this dream, we're all in this ocean together, you know, this sense of kinship, and this is dedicated to be an effective action that has a resonant participation in New York City at the same time, yeah?
That's correct. You know, one of the hallmark sayings of the ILWU is, an injury to one is an injury to all. Now, what an amazing unifying thought coming from the labor movement. And we are all connected. You know, what happens to one of us in one part of the world affects all of us, especially the over 500 innocent children that have been killed in this senseless bombing. 100,000, more than 100,000 people are displaced from their homes in Gaza. You know, it's we feel that. It's an intense shock to the international, the global heart, and we're workers, we're individuals, we're activists, we're concerned people, and we're going to show up and put our bodies out there to say, you know, we support a blockade of this state that is committing these crimes.
And again, you know, again, on public forums, people go, well, what about the horrible things going on in Syria? And we go, that is horrible. That is horrible. Mm-hmm. What about, you know, in Iraq? We go, that is horrible. All of that. You know, let us all step into the ocean of kinship and may it dissolve all that divides us. You know, underneath everything, we're all born from these waters of life. And yes, we deplore, you know, any hyper-yang death frenzy, sociopathic killing of life in all places. This is one place that we're beginning now, but all places, absolutely. So is there any other exhortation before I reluctantly let you go, but we'll invite you back to do a full show? Wonderful increasing ally John Perulis.
Yeah, thank you, Caroline. You can all go to the KPFA website, which is kpfa.org, and click on the left side. There's a little video camera link, and that will take you to our live video page. And starting at 7 a.m. Pacific, we'll be out there on the docks covering the picket, and speakers and individuals who care to come up to the microphone will be doing that till roughly about 10 a.m. So check it out.
And also there's so much being posted now. One, there's an incredibly beautiful Palestine honoring mural unveiled in Oakland. Oakland is so happening. And so, you know, shout out to Hub Oakland and Chanda, and we will be cahooting in the fall with them. But Oakland, whoa, you know, a cauldron of renaissance. So this beautiful Palestinian honoring mural by many, many participants, many fabulous humans unveiled, and it's also connected, you know, as humans prepare for Block the Boat. But that mural can be seen in Oakland between Telegraph and Broadway. And also, if you want to join the action Block the Boat, you can text There's a text alert. You can text JOIN to 510-346-5951, and presumably that will also be on KPFA.org's website, yes?
Yes.
Yes.
That's correct. All the links are there, and if you're on Facebook, there's a Block the Boat Facebook page, and our page also, International Labor Media Network is on Facebook, and we all urge you to like that page and check it out. All the maps on how to get to the Saturday action are there, past videos. It's an excellent site of international and for international workers.
And of course, as we segue into the next part of our show with Wallace J. Nichols, and also into the rest of our lives forever, at the action in Oakland on Saturday and everywhere, we want to invite the ocean herself to participate. Let nothing inimical to life be transported upon the water. So thank you very much, John Baroulis, and let us kahoot in perpetuity. More, we will do more shows, and maybe one day I will be your neighbor.
Yes, thank you. Caroline, God bless you. I love you.
Great pleasure. Okay, right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
So we are seamlessly, of course, segueing to wonderful Wallace J. Nichols, author of Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. As many great reviews are being written about this book, but it says Wallace J. Nichols is proving magic. So welcome, Wallace.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's always great to speak with you.
It is wonderful. Well, I'm so happy that your book is going out with such, as you said, it's on the New York Times bestseller science list. And, I've known you and admired you, peripherally over the years, and we've cahooted on radio. But it's like, go teammate, go agent of renaissance out there into the world. Look, there you are paddling on your board out into the big ocean and being so well received by all the critters. And then I was so delighted, just even in the beginning, and the beautiful preface by Céline Cousteau, the sea, once it casts its spell, holds one in its net of wonder forever. People protect what they love. That's
indeed
her grandfather's famous quote.
Mm-hmm.
So intimacy, the restoration of intimacy, we do protect what we love, and knowledge ultimately will guide us to the restoration of intimacy, and Venus rises from the ocean. And I saw so many people, just even in the first chapters of your book that I know, Lisa Starr on Block Island is a great buddy of mine, and Dennis Dutton was a really, really interesting radio guest. Maybe a little homage to Dennis because he's joined the ancestors, but he wrote that incredibly interesting book about how all of us are keyed to landscapes and landscapes with water.
Indeed, this is not a competition between land and water, between green and blue, or sometimes people say, well, I'm a mountain person, not an ocean person. And yeah, the answer is yes. And aren't the mountains great when there's a river flowing, or when you hike up to a lake, and it's all of our waters. And these waters do things for us and with us that we scientists have had a hard time getting our heads around and bringing into, bringing to the decision makers, bringing into our conferences, and usually you can hear the eyeballs rolling in people's heads when you talk about feelings or the emotional connection to water. We're sort of taught to check that at the door. And so what the goal here is with this book is to kick that door open and leave it open and enter in to this conversation about what's going on in our heads when we step up to the water.
Or maybe swoosh it open. Swoosh.
Yeah, swoosh it. Yeah.
Swoosh.
With our tails.
right. Well, no, I think this is at the heart of it, and the timing is so perfect because this conversation is happening everywhere. It's part of composting our hardened hearts and sociopathy that allows us to do terrible things. Exactly what you take on, the false separation of emotion and science when they belong together. When I went to the TEDx Gulf presentation after the, ongoing ecocide of the Gulf, but the scientists, the profound scientists, were all weeping. They were all weeping. It's like a breakthrough tarot card. They could not keep their emotions away from their knowledge. In fact, the knowledge was increasing their emotion.
Mm-hmm. And the oyster men and the oyster women, the fishers, everyone who looked at the water in order to reduce their stress, the people who loved to walk the beaches, all of that emotion in front of that oil spill, all of the opportunity to reduce your stress by going to the water, those are the costs that we have such a hard time talking about. All the inspiration that we get at the water, all the love and the romance that happens at the edge of the water when that oil hit and when our pollution hits all of our waters, those are the things that are also removed, along with the destruction of biodiversity and our economy and the jobs and the things we are able to document more clearly. There's all this other stuff that makes life worth living that we have such a hard time talking about. And here we are talking about it.
Well, no, we want to. I mean, one of the earliest difficult books I read as some kind of precocious, I can't remember, very young person, but was on Minamata in Japan, where the mercury had poisoned the water and there were all these illnesses. And exactly as you say, people would go to the water and go, how could the ocean, who is, you know, the mother of everything, be poisoning us? How could this be? And then in once beautiful Aleppo in Syria, the oldest, once the oldest continuous souk in the world, 2,500 years of being a marketplace until now. But when wonderful Deborah Felmuth and another friend and I were guided to the heart, the 2,500-year-old heart of this once beautiful souk, and they said this was the earliest mental health hospital 2,500 years ago, and people were healed by being here and listening to the sound of water. That's so the oldest mental health therapy in the world, you know, from Aleppo, Syria, may it be praised, was just listening to water. I go,
so true.
So then, of course, since you are reuniting emotion and science, because they do belong together, and, you know, people need not be shamed away from kinship and feeling, and again, poetry and science, because that's what you're doing so beautifully, you know, they belong together. So the neurobiology of happiness, you start us off and go, you know, our brains were, of course, born in, you know, we're nurtured in water before we're born. Our brains are 60% water. So the neurobiology of happiness and the, you know, neuroplasticity of the brain and what happens to our brain when we're in water. Guide us, oh great sailor, Wallace J. Nichols, into this realm of how do we prove what we intrinsically know, going, we love being by the ocean. Okay.
Well, yeah, we can go way back and you know, the understanding that life came from water. We emerged from the water. We carry water in us. Our, you know, our salinity is similar, although not identical, to the salinity of the ocean. Yeah, at birth, we're a higher percentage water that decreases over our lives, gets down to around 60%. Our brains are mostly water, and our brains are sitting in saline solution in the dark right now, doing what they do so well. So water is important to live. We need to keep hydrated. We can go for a while without food, but we don't get very far without water. So finding the water and positioning ourselves relative to the water has been something that life has done forever, always. Being able to know that it is, in fact, water, to hear it, to see it, to understand it, and then to position ourselves into its proximity is a matter of survival. Nowadays, we still have that ability and that those feelings that say, oh, okay, I'm near water. I feel okay. I feel safe. I feel secure. I'm gonna make it. But we also have taps. You know, we have bottles. We have refrigerators, and our need to find that water in that same way for a lot of people, of course, around the world, people still do have to walk and search for water. But in our modern society, we don't. So we still have that ability, and it gets used for other things. We vacation by water. We relax by water. We have our ceremonies by water. And when we're there listening to the sound of the water and seeing the light that's coming off of the water, it puts us at ease. It switches us into what we call blue mind, often out of red mind. So if we've got busy lives, there's a lot of noise, there are rallies, there's news, there's a lot of information coming in, and I call that that state red mind, and some people may refer to it as monkey mind. And when you step away from it, although
we don't want to diss monkeys, we don't want to.
No, monkeys are great,
and they love water. They love water too. But yes, okay.
Yeah, red mind is incredibly important. It'll help get us out of trouble. It'll help us fight when we need to fight. It'll help us run when we need to run. But if we have red mind all the time, it's deadly. It makes us sick. So finding those places by the water are incredibly important to just giving ourselves a break, giving your brain a release, and feeling more creative. So when you're at the water, visually things are simpler, auditorily things are simpler, and your brain takes a little bit of a break. If you're in the water, you get an even more of a break. Because your body is not working to keep you upright or dealing with gravity and balancing you, so your brain gets another bit of that vacation feeling.
And I think you quote Oliver Sacks as saying that he goes for a swim and then he gets an idea and he has to get out to go to shore and write it down, and then he swims some more and gets another idea. That it's in water where his thoughts begin to come together. I think we know that. I mean, there are times when the ocean is my favorite thing, where in times of stress, human stress, global stress, personal stress, I must like a turtle get to the sea. It's so intrinsic. And you also, the first glimpse of ocean, I remember first ocean, and you were working with kids when you were in, I guess, Mexico, southwestern part of this country into Mexico, and you took some of these tribal teens to the Sea of Cortez, right?
Right, so we used to take groups of teenagers from the Tohono O'odham Nation to visit the ocean, which is and was part of their culture, to make a pilgrimage to the sea to get shells and salt and seafood. And many of the kids had never been to the ocean, and so we would organize trips with the kids and go see the ocean. And it was always a wonderful experience and always a learning experience for everyone, but really more than that, more than learning about the life in the ocean, it was deeply transformative to understand yourself and to understand our planet in that way, to experience seawater and to get in it and to get under it is a transformative experience for most people.
And you put a snorkel on one of your young friends, and he was like, "Wow, what is yeah, exactly."
Yeah, so we got there, and we a lot of the kids didn't even own shorts, so we sat on the beach and we got out a knife and cut the legs off our pants, and then we got in the ocean and shared some masks and snorkels, and everybody put their face under, and one kid said, "Well, I can't see anything. There's, what's going on?" I said, "Let me check your mask." And we cleaned it and put it back on. Still couldn't see anything. And then I realized that I had forgotten to say you can open your eyes underwater. And he did. And then he really it was a joyous moment. And he was gone for an hour, just following fish and discovering himself and discovering the ocean that he just met. And a really fantastic moment.
And as many, many great quotes are sprinkled, wafted throughout your book. I love Kurt Vonnegut saying, "In the water, I am beautiful." You go, yes, weightless, gliding, we are mermaids, sea creatures. We did come from there. And I love, you also quote Alan Watts, "You didn't come into this world, you came out of it like a wave from the ocean. You are not a stranger here." So yeah, biophilia. So one of the things that you know, I think you are animating, and that we all want to animate as part of, you know, to be medicine people. Again, poor coolness on hot conflagration is, I like humans at the beach, you know, even a crowded beach, you know, like the Delaware beach, you know, people there, not radio so much, but even just people at the beach, it brings out the best. So I want to invite us all to think of, you know, even people that we might be angry with or who have lost their souls or who are cruel, as little kids at the beach again going, there you go, back there. Because it does bring out the best. And
it does. And
humans playing at the beach is one of our important default settings going, yes, may it be, you know, go play at the beach. I wish you that.
And we know that. And I think this book is a bold underlining of what we intuitively all know. And so in that sense, it's a review of something you already know, and it reads that way, and it's a very familiar set of ideas. But then we go a bit deeper and we look at the brain and what's going on, and you know, realizing that when we feel awe and wonder, our brain is primed for compassion and empathy.
Yes, it connects us
to those that we're with. It connects us to that which is around us. So when we are awed by the ocean, we're set up to take care of it, and we're set up to fall more deeply in love with it and those that we're with. So that's what you feel when you're at the beach, or you're at the river or the lake, and you're in water with your fellow humans. You feel that. I've got two little girls, and if we're having a rough day and it's not going so well, we hit the beach. We hit the ocean. As soon as we touch the beach, the sand, and as soon as we touch the ocean, it's like a big giant reset button. It's wonderful, and the day starts again, and it's fresh, and it's not about forgetting about the conflict, and it's not about just living, ignorantly of all the things you need to fight for and deal with, but it's about not burning out and not getting sick and not letting stress become toxic, and knowing that our water, the waters around us that we love, are one way we can escape the red mind. And when we understand that, hopefully we care for those waters even more in new ways and with more passion, because we understand the value that they have, that isn't just about the fish and isn't just about the oxygen, although that's important, and isn't just about the jobs and our GDP, although that's important too. It's all this other stuff that makes our lives good. Yeah.
Right, and the giant reset button. I think diving into the ocean always feels like a molecular recombobulating of everything that's been decombobulated. And I prefer warm water. I prefer the Caribbean, but I so love water. I will go in anywhere. Christmas Day, the Irish Sea. I'll do it. Just because it is such a, you know, and I think we remember all those times going, oh, you know, and how we get into cold water going, just don't tense up, let it go through you. Because on the other side of this wall of is incredible pleasure, and that I think is a very literal metaphor to carry with us. So we're going to take a break in 2 minutes, and then come back, you know, for a whole unfurling too. But the giant reset button, what is the physiology of that? Because there you were, you know, wired up, you know, your brain wired up as you got into the North Carolina ocean, and you know, to measure what would happen to your brain. How is it a reset button for us?
Well, there's a neural network that scientists call the default mode network, which is a network of brain regions that's activated when we're at the edge of water, when we have that feeling of awe, when our visual systems are simplified and tuned down, and things are quieter and there's sort of open space, and that default mode network is good for a certain kind of thinking. And that kind of thinking is, you know, self-referential. It's the feeling of kind of the feeling of oneness, or the innovative or, you know, outside the box kind of thinking. And it's in those moments when it kind of feels like poetry just drops into your head, fully formed, And there it is. And that's what Oliver Sacks refers to. As he swims around lakes or back and forth in pools, he says he feels like a porpoise, and he says he feels more creative, and his best ideas and his best theories and his best writing is happening as he's in the water.
Yes.
And so he in fact keeps a waterproof notebook right at the edge of the pool or on the dock at the lake so that he can discharge his brilliant ideas that then go on and become the books we love. And it's in the water, it's at the water when the brain network that we normally are in, which is actively processing a lot of information all of the time, including right now, is very busy, very hard at work. But when we give it a break, we switch over to a different neural network.
All right, that's great. Now, hold that thought. We're going to take a very short break. Our wonderful ally guest today is Wallace J. Nichols. His incredibly useful book acquire several at the library, give it to the library, Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. We're going to be exploring much more right after break, and we'll be right back.
She shook the constellation and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellation and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Shiny, 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 come blow my shiny home. Jenny, Jenny, come blow my Jenny home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, Allies to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our guest today is longtime ally of all life on this planet, Wallace J. Nichols. His beautiful book that is spiraling out there to in the great ocean of all who need it, which is really everyone, Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. And so where we were, I paused you mid-thought, but the neurophysiology of why water and how we are kin in our brains, and I don't know if you saw Miyazaki's his film a few years ago that he made especially for very young kids on healing our relationship to the ocean. Did you see that?
I did. Yes.
Yeah. And
lovely.
It is lovely, and it was so interesting, and your young daughters and your work with young people. Because he said, he's an elder ally now, and he said he is concentrating a lot of his work on young people, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, as our hope to heal human relationship to the sea. Again, and you're really doing that as well, yeah?
Absolutely, and I think there it's so important that At a young age, we experience and maximize the experience of awe and wonder. And I worry a bit that some of the activities that we do in our eagerness to teach about the problems may undermine that in some ways. And what I mean by that is if you take a group of kids, young kids, to the beach for the first time, and the activity that you do is cleaning up other people's trash, you spend the day picking up some pretty disgusting stuff that people leave behind along our coasts. That memory or potential memory of awe and wonder may be diminished or not occur, and the memory can be replaced with, "Wow, I went to the beach, I saw the ocean for the first time, and we picked up trash." And I think that could be a mistake. So, just using that as an example, you go for the awe first and the immersion and the wonder and talk about it and let kids know that they've got this incredible brain that's experiencing these emotions, and in an age appropriate way, you can lean into that science. And so I think the bigger idea that this is all getting at is that ecological literacy is important along with neuroliteracy, understanding our own brain and our environment, ourselves, and how we all interact. And we can do that now because we're in the golden age of neuroscience, and that's a pretty exciting idea to bring to environmental and outdoor educators and say, hey, you know, talk about this stuff, talk about the blue mind, talk about the cognitive and emotional and social benefits. It sounds kind of clunky, but there's a more poetic way to talk about it with kids. But do that when you go to the ocean. Don't just talk about the limpets and the tide pools and the tides and the algae, although yes to all of that. Go deeper into the conversation about how that all makes you feel, how stepping out of the city to the coast, how does that make you feel? And that's, I think, what the kids carry with them. And then later on, when they're in positions to have different kinds of influence, they'll be holding that nostalgia, those emotional memories of the places they love. And when there's a call to fight for the ocean, they'll answer it rather than think, oh, well, that ocean, yeah, that's where all the trash is. You know, they'll say, that's where I first really fell in love with myself, and that's where I fell in love with my partner, and that's where I get my best ideas. And of course, I'm going to fight for that. So I think it's key to go, you know, get it right with the kids.
And yeah, no, and animals. I mean, I love humans playing at the beach. We love kids at the beach. I love the magic moment of childhood driving towards the beach and like salt air. You could smell it. You're getting to this big thing, and then the pounding and the incredible joy. And then yes, there's another friend of radio, you know, that we've hosted on the radio show, Roz Savage, who rode across the sea, is also in your book. But the reason I find this so wonderful that your book and your dedication is spiraling out is that it's so, I mean, it's timeless, it's ancient, we need to know it all the time, but especially now. You know, I'd hosted Elizabeth Gilbert and her really pretty great book, Signature of All Things, and at the end of it, she has her character is kind of, has come up with Darwinian theory before Darwin, and Darwin publishes his book. It's set in 19th century. But what the character in Elizabeth Gilbert's book knows, and Darwin knows, is that there's something missing from this theory of predator-prey as the great engine of evolution on this planet, which is one true story, and what's missing is altruism. It doesn't fit into the theory. What accounts for that? And we go, oh, here comes Neptune, here comes dreams, here comes the ocean, here comes this thing that has been, that again, as you're taking it on, that, you know, you can be an intelligent person or a feeling sentimental person, you know, and, you know, soft-hearted, and again, we've been shamed away from kinship until now. All right, here we go. You know, the feeling, and when Carolyn Raffensperger would talk to scientists at the EPA and, you know, fish and wildlife, you know, government agencies, they would thank her because she would read poetry and weep and everything. And they would say, we feel like that too, but we're not allowed to say it, that we really do love the fish. We do, yeah. But we can't say it or we'll lose our jobs and our credibility and our, you know, whatever, and our manhood. Okay, so now back, you know, to now we want to, this, you know, renaissance that we need of kinship, you know, it is the ocean, you know, as you say, you know, I mean, for as long as humans have memory, you know, our imagination has been tied to the ocean. But we then do get to, and I want your informed encouragement in this realm. You know, we say, what species, you know, would poison the ocean? We go, well, a species that had lost its mythology of kinship and the imaginative kinship. And so only the healing of our imaginations can heal the sea, and only the healing of the sea can heal our imaginations. So now we move into this realm of the grown-up realm. We don't burden ourselves or our child selves or children with, but with the poison. You know, and I just got back from British Columbia, beautiful, beautiful, apparently pristine sea, and yet all the sea fish are dead. And apparently everywhere. And you can explain to us why. It's the acidification of the ocean. But I'd also heard that starfish are dead, and they were all purple. But that starfish, even in aquariums, are dying. Is that true?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of things at play, certainly in the ocean right now, that makes life a lot harder. Warming, acidification, all linked to climate change, and along with that, different kinds of outbreaks, so different kinds of wasting diseases that affect different species in different ways. As the currents and the temperature is changing, the ocean is changing, and on the whole, it's bad news. To say that there is an ocean crisis is accurate. It's not alarmist. It's absolutely true. And whether it's the warming and the bleaching of the coral reefs or the diseases that are hitting the starfish along our coast, or overfishing and overhunting of a wide range of species that people like to eat or think they like to eat, that are aphrodisiacs and or simple protein that become fish meal for poultry and so on. We're kind of hitting the ocean from all directions, and you add to that this huge problem and growing problem that's plastic pollution. And so you open any oceanographic journal, and it's a lot of bad news. And most of the ocean news that we read about in science journalism is bad news. There's not a lot of good, hopeful ocean news being reported. And to me, that just reminds us that we've got a lot of work to do. We've got an ocean to fight for. But it's not over yet. I go out, to the beach daily, and there's a lot going on out there still. There's a lot of life. It's not over. The Pacific Ocean is not dead. Long way away from being toast, as you might hear or read. It's not dead yet, and we still have a lot to fight for. A lot of beauty, a lot of diversity, and in some cases, growing populations of animals, such as the Eastern Pacific green sea turtle, is doing better than we've seen in 40 years. It's the population is growing, and that did not come easily. It came through the work of thousands of people working very, very hard for 40 years. But we can do it. We can turn things around. And even if you look at the case studies of success with regard to protection of the ocean, what you'll find at the core is a group of people who are passionate and deeply in love with their ocean, with our ocean, and each other, and who love each other and love their work and love the ocean, love the animals, love what they do, and are not giving up. And are fighting for decades and decades and decades and finding success. And that, how do you make more of that is, really one of the fundamental questions in this book. Well, one of the ways you do it is you get in the water. And when you're going to get in the water, take someone with you who hasn't been in the water, such as those kids in Arizona when we went to Mexico. Grab someone. Say, hey, have you been in the ocean this year or ever? You want to come with me? Let's go and get in, splash around, get cold, get warm, do it all. And that's not to be forgotten. Yeah.
Well, and it's one of the themes I keep, working with and inviting us all to tease forth. Let all natural facts be social strategy metaphors. So to protect wolves, become more like wolves and informed about how to do that, to protect water, become more like water, and as you're suggesting, and get in the water. I do remember one of the best divinations I ever had in Cuba from my padrino, my santero, and he said, you are daughter of Yamaya, or goddess of the ocean. And he did say, she loves you so much that you shouldn't go to the edge of the ocean if you are too sad because she will take you back. I'm like, oh, okay, all right, okay. Don't go complain to the ocean. Go, right, I've got that. It's a, and don't swim out too far. Anyway, so that was that realm for me. But yes, ecstatic self-loss. I mean, if we all think of, you know, when are those moments where we are, you know, ecstatic, where we are not bound by, you know, tribal descriptions of ourselves or gender descriptions or even species descriptions. And for me, it is diving through a wave. It's like, you know, and that's the quality we want. So I appreciate you. I mean, you are dedicated, and we do want, you know, freedom. But you know, might there be other words in addition to fighting for the ocean that are not completely red words? We don't want to. I mean, I know your assignment is to be, you know, a credible mystic. So we want you to, you know, be able to go far and influence everyone. You know, so, you know, more whimsical things. You know, we're going to swoosh for the ocean, swim for the ocean. You know, whatever for the ocean. But is there another oceany kind of word that would be blue about our dedication to protect it?
Oh, you know, I, very good point. And the work that I've done with fishermen to bring sea turtles back rarely involves fighting.
Right.
Rarely. I mean, I told myself a story about, well, we have to fight for the turtles, but that doesn't mean we're fighting against someone.
But we're strengthening our kinship with the turtles.
Yeah, better said. And you know, it's been a collaboration. The success has been finding the common ground, so if you're speaking with a sea turtle hunter and you're a turtle protector and a biologist, what's the common ground? Well, many times they don't want the turtles to go extinct either. They hunt them to eat them and sell them, but they don't want them to go extinct. And so that's a starting point for finding some language to dig into and say, well, if you don't want them to go extinct and I don't want them to go extinct, what might we do together to make sure that that doesn't happen?
Yes.
And
no,
then you can find what that is if you spend the time, build the trust, have some beers or some coffee together or whatever it is, and spend the time talking about it. And that's what's worked. That's really the only thing that's worked. The fighting doesn't work. It ends up, you end up with maybe a law that's hard to enforce, or you win a little battle, but it's short-lived. And so, very, very good point. I probably won't use the word fight as much.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, again, the trickster or Uranus, you know, would say, you humans can do anything you want. We don't really care. We care the manner in which you do it, that it be from freedom and choice. So as part of your rich, ever-expanding, wonderful vocabulary and service to life, you know, whenever it suits you, but let it be a choice. So that we have many ways we're dedicated to strengthening our kinship or strengthening, whatever, many, many things. But it does remind me also of a great ally, green builder David Johnston, when he goes, you know, to the South into Republican land and says, you all love hunting, right? You love killing little things, you know. I mean, he doesn't say it in a demeaning way. They go, yes, we do. And he goes, well, then we got to protect the forest, right? It's the same idea. And it's also, you know, I mean, you do a great job of this is, you know, one, but the ocean is not, you know, there creatures in the ocean kill each other and eat each other. It's not hunting. It's not predator. But it is about, you know, respect. But in that realm, yeah, I've had a life changing encounter with sea turtle. You've certainly been dedicated to sea turtles and you delineate, you know, these emissaries from the sea, you know, if we are receptive, you know, anywhere, I mean, the ocean's capable of anything, which is part of what, you know, you probably have less fear than most people, because it's like, oh, it's dark and I'm a little bug on the surface. Ah, anything could happen. You probably know more to quell your fear. I don't know. Are you ever frightened in the water?
When waves are big,
yeah.
It's appropriate to be afraid of the ocean. I mean, there's a reason. When you're afraid, there's often something to it. It isn't just Shark Week getting you all amped up. Right. There's usually some some reason to step back and maybe move a little higher.
Right.
Put your life vest on, or, you know.
Well, it's respect, and it's like, you know, when I first started going to the Caribbean, it's like, check out what the locals do. They don't really go swimming with silver jewelry at night. There's a reason. There's a reason for that. But your connection to turtles, and then I'm pretty sure throughout your book there's sea turtle encounters that are important. I love this idea of the, you know, when we're available, like the whole theme of amakuas in Hawaii. You know, what is my amakua? And right away, creature shows up going, I am. Do you have a is there a sea turtle story from the book that, you know, as an emissary?
Well, there's a great story that doesn't involve me, that is a Michael J. Fox story.
Oh, yeah.
He was spending time at the beach and went for a swim and ran into a sea turtle, or swam up to a sea turtle, and found himself following it for a while, and time passed and he lost track of time and finally made his way back to the beach where his wife was waiting, and she said, he said, I'm done. And she said, good. You know, you're probably all pruney and, you know, you've been in the water forever. He said, no, I'm done. I quit. I'm done with TV. I'm going to focus on my foundation. And he made a major life decision, a major career shift, while just following a sea turtle underwater. And he later says, I never looked back. I never regretted the decision. I never second guessed it. It was as clear as I've ever been about anything, and there's something really great in there, and it's the sea turtle, but it's also the context of being, you know, underwater, and spending that time and letting your brain be creative and think differently and be imaginative, and getting that kind of clarity, and then not looking back and just deciding that's what I need to do. And I love that story because we know the rest of it, where he's done so much to raise awareness about Parkinson's and work so hard on his health. But it was a pivotal moment in his life and his career. And it happened underwater with a turtle.
Yes. No, again, we get into Big Mind, and then just briefly, because I did write about it, but in a very short way, but yes, in Hawaii, on the Big Island, and beautiful beach, and wonderful sea turtle, and I'm following it. And then these annoying Yahoo, you know, tourists were like, hey, let's mess with the sea turtle, let's wait. Anyway, I pretended to be official. I was like, I am from the Department of Fisheries, and no messing with that turtle. They're like, and anyway, they went away. But I swear the sea turtle then went, you know, and looked back to make sure I was following. I'm really sure. And we went all around, and we went through these canyons and everything. And then we came to this underwater canyon, and there were hundreds of sea turtles wafting around these kind of fairy tale sculptures of rock, like everywhere. And for me, it was the sea turtle said, you did me a favor, so I take you to Sea Turtle World. And I think this, you know, this kindness, it is a fairy tale. The water is, you know, the birth of, you know, dreams, vision, mythology, fairy tales, kinship, reciprocity. You do me a favor, and I'll do you a favor. You do this thing, I'll do this thing. The magic salmon is very important in fairy tales. The fish of prophecy. I mean, all of that.
Absolutely.
So you are fully informed of, like, ah, but heartened by the resilience of the ocean, if we just take the poison off it. But I know we are both allies of wonderful Michael Stocker, and I was with him when the Gulf ecocide was beginning, and again all the scientists were weeping, and all the poet scientists as well, and saying, you know, this, it will recover in some thousands of years, and as you point out, and it suffuses your beautiful book Blue Mind, you know, we are a little blue planet, you know, we're a little, you know, and you say, why do we call it Earth? We could call it ocean, because we're really mostly ocean. So are you sanguine about long-term and even medium-term recovery of ocean? And certainly your book is dedicated to this, that, you know, again, people protect what they love, and knowledge, enough knowledge guides them into intimacy and love. How are you feeling these days, and what do you want us to do with this knowledge, Wallace?
Yeah, I usually don't give prescriptions for, you know, the what to do for the ocean. I've started just asking, you know, what do you think you can do?
Right.
And people have good ideas. I would say everybody listening, if you said, what do you think you can do for the ocean, their answers would be brilliant. And then I would say, well, do that. And that's not a cop out. There's 50 things you can do for the ocean, lists that abound. But, you know, people know what they can do differently, and just dig into that and do it. And if you feel like adding a couple more things, do that. But I think, you know, I really do think getting young people, take them to the ocean, get in there and talk about how it feels, and talk about what that's good for. We need to build a bigger movement, and we need more people engaged in this conversation than we've got right now. And we do see, when we give the ocean a break, it comes back. When we stop killing things in an area, there are, you know, stop killing animals in an area, there are more animals when we let them repopulate. And we need to keep doing that. And, you know, Sylvia Earle calls them hope spots. And I would evolve that into hopescapes, areas where the ocean gets a break, where, like on land, where we have parks, parks in the water, marine protected areas, they're called. And give the ocean a break there. Don't drill. Don't throw nets in the water. And let animals come back. It works, and we need to do more of it. And there is a strong movement behind creating those marine protected areas around the world. And the key is that they're real, not just on paper, that they, in fact, have buy-in, as they say, people who live near them are in agreement and support their establishment. So there are things happening. There are things we can all do. And then the plastic issue is a tough one, because the story there is it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. There's a lot more attention on the issue of plastic pollution in the ocean now than there was last year, certainly a ton more than there was 5 years ago. And 10 years ago, it was barely a conversation outside of a few journals and a few people. And so that's progress. But given the numbers and the amount of this material that exists in our current production, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Right, but I think that's, you know, we are willing to offer ourselves, oh ocean, we are really sorry, and rivers and water, to partner with you. Only by partnering with these things can we alleviate the misery we've imposed as humans. Yes, and you're doing a splendid job, you agent of the ocean who's crawled up and disguised yourself as a human, Wallace J. Nichols. That's very wonderful, you as ambassador from the seas. So all good wishes to you. May you be replenished, and resilient means to jump back and, you know, carry on. And may your book, Blue Mind, spiral forth to all. And if there's any other water blessing, we have 4 seconds here. Any other water blessing you want to spiral forth, feel free, Wallace J. Nichols.
Well, the last words of the book are simply, I wish you water.
Yes, yes.
And that has many different meanings for people. And I just invite you to have it mean what it means to you.
We do.
In this time of water time.
Of dire beauty. Thank you so much, Wallace J. Nichols. Wonderful book, Blue Mind. Thanks always to Douglas Bell in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Specials are up till the end of the day. And we will reconvene next week. And thank you, John Perulis, as well. I will telepathically see you on Saturday at the Oakland Shipyard. Thank you, team. Woof.
naturalist Diane Ackerman? You should. Jared Diamond says her vivid writing, inexhaustible stock of insights, and unquenchable optimism have established her as a living treasure. Diane is bringing us surprising new perceptions of nature and scientific developments certain to deepen and brighten your view of the future. Diane will be in Berkeley Thursday evening, September 18th, 7:30 at St. John's Church, 2727 College Avenue. This KPFA benefit, Wheelchair Accessible, will be hosted by Vijaya Nagarajan, delightful professor of religious, spiritual, and environmental studies. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com or supportive bookstores. For September 18, the inspiring Diane Ackerman.